Leonard Davis is a disability studies scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And just in time for the 25th anniversary of the ADA, he published his latest book, Enabling Acts, the hidden story of how the Americans with Disabilities Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights. We met on Skype, and he taught me the real lesson in how a bill becomes a law. Thank you so much for taking the time and creative technology to make this happen for Intersections Radio. The book is called Enabling Acts, the hidden story of how the Americans with Disabilities Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights. Well, this is basically the history, the story of the Americans with Disability Act. And early on in the book, you discuss how disability rights should be treated as civil rights. That is to say, a disability is like an ethnicity or race that must be protected from abuses, which if you're not in this field already, I think that might feel like a new concept for people. So talk a little bit more about this.
Yeah, I think for the average person, it's hard to understand, or might be slightly difficult to understand, that disability is an identity category, for one thing, and that people with disabilities have a right to be full participants in their culture and in their society. So, I mean, the idea about civil rights and what the Civil Rights Act, say, for example, of 1964 did was to say, look, you know, there are people in our country, and they, although it says in the Constitution and all of our laws that they have a right to full citizenship, the way things are working out is that they're not getting the full citizenship. So we're going to pass this law to really make clear that what the rights are of people in the 1964 Act of people of color. So the point is that if you're a person with disabilities and you are not enjoying your full rights as a citizen, then that needs to be taken care of as well. And so that was really the big ideological shift, if you want, that came about somewhere between the 1970s and the 1980s. Because initially, all of the disability legislation was really geared to rehabilitation of soldiers, for the most part, of providing services and funding for people with disabilities on a very kind of rehab level. And it wasn't really until post-civil rights, until various other groups like women and gays and lesbians began to say, hey, you know, we're part of the culture and society, but we don't have our rights either. That template of the Civil Rights Act began to apply to other identity groups. So when people with disabilities got together, saw that their various disabilities, you might be blind, you might be deaf, you might be you might have a chronic disease, you might have psychological problems, but those things all are grouped under the issue of having a disability. And for many people, those rights that they would have as normal citizens were being denied to them.
I like the idea that you were saying that the civil rights movement served as a template for, you know, more minority groups to use for their political purposes and for rights as citizens. In fact, you were saying in the book that people with disabilities didn't see themselves as a political movement. They saw themselves as people who had a medical problem that needed treatment. How did this attitude change and become the movement?
Well, I, as I said, there were organizations for various particular disabilities. I mean, there's the National Association of the Deaf. There are organizations for blind people. There's ARC for people with cognitive disabilities. There's Cerebral Palsy Association, the Muscular Dystrophy. So each of these were separate organizations that tried to lobby and raise money on behalf of people with those conditions. By the way, most of those organizations were run by people who are not disabled. Not all, but most of them. And, you know, the ones we know best, the telethons that were done in the 1950s and continued until very recently, those organizations like the March of Dimes and the Muscular Dystrophy Association were run and controlled by people without disabilities. So these organizations, in many cases, saw themselves as having a kind of paternalistic, charity-like role. And so when that began to change was, first of all, most dramatically in Berkeley, for example, around the independent living movement. So somewhere in the 1960s, and this story is known by lots of people, but Ed Roberts was a student who was coming into Berkeley, and he was basically told that, you know, he was admitted without their knowing that he was a wheelchair user, and he was post-polio. But when he tried to come on campus, they basically said, look, if you want to come into the dorms, we can't accommodate you. And he did need an iron lung to function for part of the day at least. And so they said, look, if you want to come, you could stay in the hospital. And so Ed Roberts and around him and a group of other people at Berkeley basically said, look, you know, that's not being a student, is having to live in the hospital. We want to start thinking about ourselves as people who have independent lives, that we can live on our own, and we don't need paternalistic organizations. So in Berkeley, there were the beginnings of the independent living movement, in which there was the first center, I think, was in Berkeley, and the idea was that these were centers that were going to be run by people with disabilities, and they were going to help other people with disabilities find living conditions, jobs, assistance, supports, animal companions if needed, and so on. And that was the beginning of a kind of activism. Linked up with that was a group called ADAPT, which started in Texas. And that group also, a lot of the people in ADAPT, not all of them, but a lot of them were Vietnam vets returning. And they were particularly focused on the fact that transportation was not easily available, and they became kind of what I call them in the book, the Hell's Angels of disability activists. I mean, they would show up, and they were looking very hippie in 60s, you know, in various places, and get arrested, chain themselves in front of buses. And so that kind of activism around transportation was very important. Judy Heumann in New York had a group that blocked traffic on Madison Avenue. And so that was kind of the beginning, at least around mobility and independent living. But it was really, what really pulled the different groups together was issues around Section 504.
Yes, that was actually my next question. That and the takeover of the federal building, which you said was the longest occupation in history. So yes, please talk about Section 504.
Okay, so in the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which is really basically designed to be a rehab act, it contained a couple of important things. One was there was inserted in there funding for independent living centers around the U.S. And so the one that started in Berkeley, people started them in other cities, and I think now there are hundreds of them across the United States. But the idea was that there was going to be funding for the centers and for people living independently. At the time, the president was Richard Nixon, and so the idea of an act that would have large funds going, you know, and increase the government, and even though Richard Nixon, when we look back on it, wasn't as conservative as things are now, he was very much against the idea that that this bill should contain such a large unfunded mandate, as they now call it. And so the bill was passed in Congress and the Senate, and Nixon vetoed it. Then they tried to pass it again, and Nixon vetoed it again the second time because he didn't want the independent living funds in there. So finally, the third time around, they stripped out the funding. However, there was in the act something that nobody really noticed at the time. I mean, you know, with all the debate about the independent living funds, no one noticed that there was this little tiny section called 504. Yeah, so, you know, hidden within this bill was just a tweet-length section, Section 504, which nobody really noticed. And if you go back and look at the debates in Congress and so on, it's not mentioned at all. There's no legislative history on it. But it basically says that no otherwise qualified person could be denied their civil rights. And so once the bill was passed, I don't know who noticed it or didn't notice it. There had to be regulations. So there was a long period of writing the regulations for Section 504. And it took such a long time. I think it took 7 years before it was the regulations were signed. And during that time, Nixon, as you know, left office. And then Carter came in, and there was kind of a feeling among people with disabilities that, yeah, with Carter, it would happen quickly. And it didn't happen particularly quickly. His his Secretary of Health, HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare, Califano, just seemed to be sitting on it for a long time. And it was during this period, this is really when I think all of the disability groups banded together, and we really get a sense that, yeah, there's this cross-country, cross-disability movement that begins. And so around the country in various places, there were a lot of protests, and culminating in the San Francisco protest, in which 100 people occupied the HEW building for, I think it's 28 or 29 days. It was the longest occupation of a federal building in U.S. history. And finally, Califano was forced to sign the regulations, and they went into effect. So that, I think that you can date the concept of disability activism and a disability, cross-disability movement to that point. I mean, there were cross-disability organizations, but that's sort of like the flashpoint.
That is pretty incredible that something so short and small and seemingly, you know, invisible in this massive bill is what was the foundation for such a huge movement.
I know, it is. It's whimsical in a certain kind of way. And by the way, there's speculation about who put that in there, but there's no one has ever stepped forward and said, like, I did it. Yeah. I mean, we have a name of somebody, but that, as far as I know, that person, I was not able to locate that person. And it was probably an intern who was something like 20 years old and working. But yeah, you would think that person should be enshrined in the Disability Hall of Fame. But really, that's one of the stories, one of the things that interests me in this book that I wrote, Enabling Acts, is just the whimsical nature of the way that politics happen. You know, had that intern not put this in, there might not have been a pan-disability movement at exactly that time in that way.
Talk about the Capitol crawl and that visibility.
Yeah, so well, let me just back up for a second. I mean, there was an early version of the ADA that, I mean, nobody really expected that version to go because it was what they call the flatten the earth version. The idea was that everything would happen immediately and you'd basically flatten the world to make it accessible. So, and it, for many people, that was just an unrealistic bill. And it also didn't go through the proper channels. It came through a small group called the National Council for Disability or National Council of the Handicapped, which was a special presidential committee that was people were appointed by the president. It was kind of an inappropriate place for a bill to start. But anyway, that bill tested the waters, got people talking, and there was a bill that was introduced in 1989 that had more traction. And it took about a year for the bill to go from committee through all the committees and finally be signed by the president. There was a perception, and I say it was a perception. I don't think it was actually the case, but there was a perception on the ground among disability activists that the bill was being stalled or that there were damaging amendments being put on it. And so somewhere in the spring of 1990, ADAPT, that group I told you about, the Hell's Angels group, got together with another group. And they marched down Pennsylvania Avenue. They marched past the White House. They marched to the Capitol, and they staged what was called a crawl-in. And what they did was they abandoned their wheelchairs. This is for people with mobility impairments mostly, wheelchairs and canes and braces and crutches, and they crawled up the steps of the Capitol. It's a very dramatic event. You can see it on YouTube. It's been photographed by the kind of official photographer of disability activism, Tom Olin. And, you know, the highlight of it was a little girl who was 7 or 8 years old with cerebral palsy named Jennifer Keelan, who was climbing with great difficulty. And it was a very hot day. She's drinking water. And she says, I don't care how long it's going to take. It can take till midnight. I'm going to get to the top of those steps. So they did the crawl, obviously, retrospectively anyway, it was a great moment in disability history. What it did show many people was that there is a very active, vocal, you know, strongly felt group of people who will do anything to, you know, get this bill passed. And by the way, the same group the next day went to the Capitol Rotunda, where they were supposed to hypothetically get a tour of the Capitol, But little did the tour guide realize or know that they had all brought chains with them. And so they 50, 60 people chained themselves together in the Capitol Rotunda. And the police had to come and cut the chains and carry them off one by one to be arrested. So, you know, clearly there was a fervent feelings and dramatic events that accompanied the passage of the ADA.
These are such great stories that, I mean, with as much work I've been doing in this field, I had no idea. These are great stories. Did you have any other favorite stories from while you were writing this book or other adventures that came up along the way?
Well, there are, I mean, in my book, Enabling Acts, I do have a lot of stories and I have a lot of people. I mean, I interviewed over 50 people and I tried to make this book not a dry history of a piece of U.S. legislation, but really something that would tell the stories of many characters and many people who made this happen. And by the way, the reason the subtitle calls it a hidden story is because, you know, there is a kind of public story, including the Capitol crawl for those who know about it. But there are so many people involved in getting this bill through. I think if you've read the book, you see that. And there are many of them are hidden. I mean, this is a story of unsung people who worked behind the doors and, you know, lobbied and so on. And I think those stories are interesting. The one that kind of fascinates me, you know, and again, like you, I mean, perhaps, I mean, I didn't know that much about how a bill gets passed. I mean, I knew the jailhouse, what is it, the Schoolhouse Rock, you know, I'm a bill song, right? But I didn't really understand what goes into getting, and so part of the research for me was just the fascination of getting behind the scenes. I've been able to get a hold of things that nobody before has had. Like, I was able to get inside the White House because most people tell the story from the point of view of disability activism, but I was able to get memos and talk to people who are in the White House, and that gives us a whole other view of it. So anyway, the story that interests me, I think that might interest readers, is how this bill got going in the first place. So what happened was that there were a group of people from Berkeley, part of the whole Berkeley independent living movement. You could say Berkeley activists, Berkeley hippies, who were part of this group called DREDIF, which was a spinoff from the Center for Independent Living. And DREDIF is the education and legal defense branch. And there was a woman named Pat Wright and another woman named Arlene Mayerson, a guy named Bob Funk, who just looked at each other one day in the middle of a meeting and said, let's go to Washington. I mean, literally like that. And the reason they went was because there was, you know, Reagan was in power at that point, and Reagan's whole thing was deregulation and trying to shrink the federal budget and, you know, shrink the government. So there was a lot of legitimate fear that you know, services and things that had been hard won under 504 were going to be rolled back. So they basically, you know, got a ticket. They went to Washington. They crashed on the floor of various people, and they came there without any knowledge of Washington, without any connections. The first person whose floor they crashed on was a guy named Evan Kemp. He was a guy who was went to law school. He used a wheelchair. He went to law school, and he graduated at the top of his class and couldn't get a job. And so he began to be aware of the fact that there was this tremendous discrimination against people with disabilities, which I suppose he'd known all along, and approached Ralph Nader, and he started a Ralph Nader Raider office in Washington on DuPont Circle. He had like a tiny two rooms and a couple of desks, and he basically gave his office to the DREDIF people and let them sleep on his floor. Now, that's interesting, just as a kind of connection, but the more interesting thing is that turns out that Evan Kemp was an extremely good bridge player. He had a Thursday night kind of Washington bridge game going where a lot of, you know, some people came, and one of the people who came regularly was this guy named C. Boyden Gray, and he ended up being the legal counsel for Vice President George Bush at that time. So Kemp is playing every Thursday night with Boyden Gray. And Gray, you know, wants to learn bridge and is learning from Kemp. But in the course of that, he's also learning a lot about disability because Kemp is telling him about his experiences. And so Pat Wright, who's friends with Kemp now, sleeping on his floor, starts talking to Boyden Gray. I mean, so this is like a weird connection because Boyden Gray is a super neoconservative. His brother founded the Federalist Society. He still is one of the big people in the Federalist Society. So you got these like Berkeley hippies now with a direct connection to the interior of the White House through Boyd and Gray. Well, when Bush gets elected president, Boyd and Gray becomes the legal counsel. He is now one of the most powerful men in the United States, and he is giving, passing information, talking to, and coordinating things with people like Pat Wright. So that's kind of fascinating because I, you know, people say like, oh, the Capitol crawl was really important. And I almost think like that bridge game was almost more important. I mean, had that bridge game not been going on, it's not clear the disability activists would have ever been able to get any connections inside the White House. And by the way, Evan Camp then transferred over and started working inside the White House as a result of that.
That is a really good story. And yeah, bridge game and couch surfing, like the old school Airbnb situation. You were talking about these hidden stories. And something that I was curious about in this 25th anniversary, I've been seeing a lot of social media posts and comments that the ADA and the movement kind of looked like a white movement, that there wasn't much representation from people of color with disabilities. Do you have any thoughts or comments about that?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I know that during the Section 504 occupation in San Francisco that the Black Panthers were involved, or at least one or two were. But, you know, a lot of these people that I detail come from wealthy families, you know, and are white elite people. I think that that provided a kind of cover for what is, in essence, a kind of radical piece of legislation. You know, I mean, Justin Dart is a good example of that. I mean, he was the heir to the Walgreens fortune. So I think you needed to have this group of white, privileged, elite people to get this bill through Congress. I mean, I think that's true. And however, I mean, one of the groups that was very important was Conference on Civil Rights that was headed by Ralph Neese. Ralph Neese is not a person of color, but the organization itself was the largest group of people of color and of various ethnicities in the country. It's a coordinating committee for every single group like NAACP, CORE. I mean, you go down the line, I think there were 125 organizations. And that group, under the leadership of Neese, but still, that group really made it possible to turn the legislation into something about civil rights. But on the other hand, there is an interesting, if you want to say, somewhat of a conflict between African Americans and people with disabilities, that there's a tension there that was there. Let me just give you a couple of examples. One is that the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which we all know, was basically an act about people of color, ethnicities, and so on. A couple of years later, women were added to that. Hubert Humphrey decided that he wanted to add disability to that legislation, to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And there was a huge pushback from African Americans who did not want that. And they didn't want it because, A, they didn't want the bill watered down, as they saw it with like a lot of other groups, but also that they legitimately were worried that if the bill came back to the Senate, that there could be a lot of damaging amendments, and they didn't want to do that. So there wasn't a strong alliance, I think, until the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights came along. And then there were certain significant congresspeople, notably Major Owens, who really helped push the bill through. In fact, the two or three of them were headed by chair people of color. So by the time you get to the late 1980s, there isn't this opposition anymore. And, you know, I mean, if you look at photographs, there are photographs from the marches, you see mainly white faces, but you do see black people as well. Well, I did want to make one other point related to that, which is that was the issue that the ADA was kind of, you know, at this point was moving along, you know, compromises had been made, arms had been twisted, secret meetings had been had, and it looked like it was going through until the very last minute. And then Jesse Helms popped back up. And this time, he was all worked up about people who were HIV positive. And there was a guy named Jim Chapman. When people tell the story of the ADA, he's the bad guy. He's the super bad guy because he introduced a piece of an amendment that said that people who are HIV positive would be carved out of the ADA in the sense that they couldn't be food handlers, and that if they were food handlers, they had to be shifted to some other position. So as you can imagine, you know, the coalition of people who were pushing the ADA a lot of them, surprisingly large number of them, were gay or lesbian. You know, that one of the things that everybody had agreed on was that no identity group was going to be thrown under the bus. So when it came to this thing about HIV and wanting to say that HIV should not be considered essentially a disability in the way that other disabilities were considered, it virtually stopped the whole thing. And a lot of people decided, like, if this is going to happen, we're not going to let the ADA go through. And Jesse Helms was a big supporter of this concept. There was a compromise that was worked out, and basically Kennedy said, you know, let the science run this thing. So they have a section of the bill that says each year the Centers for Disease Control will issue a list of conditions that would be dangerous for people to handle food. And obviously being HIV is not one of them. But at the time, there was a lot of misinformation, and some people thought that AIDS could be transmitted that way. But I think that's actually interesting because it really is about another identity group that, you know, could have been thrown under the bus and wasn't.
Is there anything else, any other topics we haven't talked about?
Well, I just think that I'll just speak for myself. I mean, I've been in disability studies for a long time, and I've done a lot of books. But I really have to say that I didn't really understand a certain aspect of it that this book covers. I mean, I really got to know better the role of the disability activist community, as well as a lot of people who are behind the scenes really organizing this, because this bill would have never happened had there not been tremendous coordination through all the states and through, you know, getting people with disabilities to contact their congresspeople and senators. I mean, I think that is really important, and I think everybody should, you know, read about it and know about it. And this 25th anniversary is important. There's a long way to go. There's a lot more to do. But, you know, disability has become part of the U.S. in a way that it wasn't before. And we take so many things for granted now that were part of this act. Wheelchair lifts on buses, curb cuts, captioning on TV, relays for deaf people. I mean, these are things that are just part of the environment that we look at and just think we're always there. But I think one of the other messages here is that I asked almost all the politicians that I spoke to, Bob Dole, Orrin Hatch, Tom Harkin, all of the heavy hitters, and I said, do you think this bill could pass today? And every one of them said no. I mean, which is kind of amazing. So we have to think that if ADA came up today to be an act that would be passed, it wouldn't happen.
Why did they feel that way?
This is bipartisan legislation, and it also really... You know, if you, as I describe in the book, you had to have agreement between groups that normally don't agree with each other. You know, you had to have business say that they were willing to do this at their, you know, it's going to cost them money, it's going to inconvenience them to some degree. And you had people who are fighting for disability rights. Those are, you know, mostly Democrats on the left. You know, the left and right had to come up with a compromise and bipartisanship. That bipartisanship doesn't exist anymore today. And one example of that is the UN Treaty on Disabilities, which has been signed and ratified by every country in the United States, except for the U.S. And we signed it, but we won't ratify it. And we won't ratify it because the left and right can't agree. The right thinks that this is going to signing a UN treaty is going to impinge on the right of the U.S. government to have its own autonomy, which is completely not true. And Tea Party homeschoolers are saying, we don't want people telling us how to, you know, teach our disabled children. So that kind of unanimity is over. I mean, Bob Dole, who was a big supporter of the ADA, now is in his 90s and is very frail, came on the floor of the Senate last year and said, please pass this bill, and nobody would.
Yeah, I remember that. And that's a good point. It's sad to think we're in that current state of affairs.
Yep.
Leonard Davis, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me for Intersections Radio.
Well, my pleasure, and thanks. It was a good conversation.
That was Leonard Davis, author of Enabling Acts, the hidden story of how the Americans with Disabilities Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights. I'm Sari Gametta, and this is Intersections Radio.